Welcome to the podcast, On Things Above, a weekly discussion and devotion rooted in the Word of God and reaching toward heaven above.
Welcome back to another podcast of On Things Above. We are excited today to welcome Marshall Reed, that's Philip Marshall Reed, to our broadcast. Marshall was in the Southside training program from 2007 to 2009. He left us and went to Bulverde, Texas in the San Antonio area. He now preaches at the North Gardendale Church in Alabama. Marshall, welcome, and tell us, how are you and your family doing?
Thank you. Thank you. Definitely good to be with y'all. And we're doing good here, trying to get over the cabin fever, being cooped up for a while, but doing pretty well. Been here for 5 and a half, almost 6 years now. Penn and Jonathan are 18, and Lord willing, if everything goes as planned, we'll be heading to Florida College in the fall. Casey is going to be a junior. She is 16. Some days she's sweet 16. Some days she's not so sweet 16. Nah, seriously, she's great. She's got a somewhat of a beau that is new territory. We're having fun here, and things are doing well. It's good to see y'all, and good to talk to the Southside Church. We sure do miss everybody there. It will always hold a very, very special place in our hearts.
Well, we feel the same way about you and Lisa. And in many ways, your kids seem like our kids. We think of you often. One of the things I always loved about you, Marshall, is no matter what time of day, your greeting was usually morning.
Good morning. And, that's right.
Both of us love the morning, love coffee in the morning, and we're excited about our study together this morning. Now, you have chosen among the people of Hebrews 11 by faith Moses. Tell us, what is it about Moses that intrigues you the most?
Well, one of the things that I really love about Scripture and about how everything works together from Old to New Testament is what is called typology. And that is how there are various themes, various characters, various principles that you see throughout Scripture, both Old and New, that help to tie everything together, and all of it pointing towards the culmination in Christ, and not just in Christ in the sense of when he was here on earth, but all the mission of Christ and what he did do on earth and what he will be doing and is still doing. And Moses is a very well-known type of Christ. And we're going to be talking about that as we take a look at these verses from Hebrews 11, because the Hebrew author, I believe, references that very point, and there are many similarities between Moses and Christ that we'll be talking about. So that's always intriguing to me.
Well, it seems fitting that the Old Testament character who is mentioned the most in the New Testament, that is Moses, should have such a significant portion of Hebrews 11. So take us there, Marshall, starting in verse 23, where we learn by faith Moses.
Okay, so let's start off just by reading the verses. We'll really start in our discussion in verse 24, but we'll start in verse 23, and I'm going to read down through verse 30. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that the child was beautiful, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. So these verses talk about Moses and how he is this exemplar of faith that the Hebrew writer focuses a lot of time on. As Bubba said, he does spend many verses talking about Moses. And there are a few things that I want to bring out from this. Number one, we know that we can divide the life of Moses into three equal periods of 40 years each. He spent 40 years in Egypt, he spent 40 years in Midian, and then he spent 40 years as leader of the Israelites. The Hebrew writer focuses on the first third of Moses' life, so the first 40 years, and then the last 40 years of his life, his time in Egypt and his time leading the Israelites out of Egypt. And he makes several points here about Moses and his faith that would have been especially pertinent to the people that he's writing to. The Hebrew author knows what the people are going through, these Hebrew Christians are going through, as far as their Christian life and what they're having to endure. And so it's no surprise that he spends this time talking about Moses because of what he did and how he was a leader and how they could be like Moses and relate to Moses in many ways. So one of the first things he says about Moses is that he chose the identity with the people of God over identity with Pharaoh's house. He made a choice. When he became of age and when he looked at his Hebrew brethren, as Stephen says in Acts chapter 7, he had to make a choice. He saw what was happening with his Hebrew brethren. And specifically, as we read about in Exodus and in Acts chapter 7, there's this one particular incident where one of the Egyptian slave masters or slave task people were was oppressing one of his Hebrew brethren. And he defended his brother, his kinsman, ended up killing the Egyptian in the process. And so this choice of identity, of who am I going to identify with? Am I going to continue to identify with Pharaoh's household, or am I going to identify with the people of God? That choice was, of course, a turning point in his life, and it had its consequences. On the negative side, it meant being mistreated and suffering reproach, and it also meant giving up the pleasures of Egypt. So he was giving up quite a bit. He had it made. He was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He could have had anything he wanted. Egypt being the most powerful nation in the area at the time and full of treasure, full of pleasures, he could have had it all. But he gave that up because he saw something better. So on the negative side, it meant being mistreated and suffering the reproach. But on the positive side, now here's what's interesting about this, is on the positive side, it meant suffering reproach. So on the negative side, it was suffering a reproach, but on the positive side, it was suffering a reproach. He said that was a greater wealth, that was more valuable. How is that the case? Well, it's because he connects it to the reward. He says that he saw the reward and that was greater. So the reproach was worth it. The reproach was valuable. It was of greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, verse 26, because he was looking to the reward. And that is a theme over the book of Hebrews, is looking to the reward. In fact, if you go back up just a few verses to the previous chapter, in chapter 10, the last few verses there, you see the Hebrew author bring this up, and he, of course, is making this point to his audience that they need to look beyond the present time of suffering. Hebrews 10, beginning in verse 32, he says, "But recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. He says, you're suffering reproach, but you have a reward. That's what will keep you going. And so he draws on Moses as a premier example of this. Also in chapter 11 and verse 6, it mentions the reward as well. It says, and without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And then in some of the other examples that he gives of faith in this chapter, in verses 8 through 10, talking about Abraham and his sons and grandsons, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. But as he's about to say, that wasn't the reward. It says, for he, in verse 10, for he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. There was something beyond the physical land and the cities there. That's not where the promise truly lay. That's not where the reward truly lay. It was in a city that has foundations, this builder and maker is God. And then also in verse 13 and following, it says, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar and having a knowledge that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. And so it is that motif that the Hebrew author has already referred to several times that he now brings out in Moses and says that look at the example of Moses, how he was willing to suffer. He was willing to identify with the people of God. And he knew exactly what that was going to bring, and it was worth it. It was worth far more than he could have ever had in Egypt. And let me just fast forward also to the next chapter in verse 12, or chapter 12, that same theme is presented again, this time with Jesus, who says, and well, he's relating it to us, but also Jesus, when he says in verse 1, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus did the same thing. Moses, of course, is a type of Christ that we will talk about further in just a few minutes. But that's a very important point we need to understand, is that he was willing to suffer the reproach, and that was actually considered a reward because there was something better than the here and the now that he had in Egypt. So yes, the choice had consequences, but instead of looking at the negative consequences, he chose to focus on the positive consequences. He chose to focus on that reward and what it would mean ultimately by identifying with the people of God instead of identifying with Pharaoh's house. But there's a statement that the Hebrew author makes that kind of catches you off guard. It's not what you would expect him to say. He says that Moses was willing to suffer the reproach of Christ. But Christ isn't an Old Testament character. He's a New Testament character. So what does the Hebrew writer mean when he says that he was willing to suffer the reproach of Christ? There are various interpretations of this, but I think there are two that make the most sense, and the author may have both in mind, and they are very similar, just a few distinctions between them. But I think one of the things that has to be in mind of the author here is that it was a reproach that was at least similar to what Christ endured. That may be what he's referring to, that what Moses endured was similar to what Christ would later endure. Moses was a foreshadowing of Christ. He first of all identified with God's people. Well, guess what the Hebrew author said in Hebrews chapter 2? That Jesus became like his brethren. He had to be made like one of them. He had to suffer like them. He was not afraid to call them his brethren. So Jesus identified with God's people, just like Moses identified with God's people. And then, of course, he was a leader of God's people. That's what we're going to talk about in the second half, is being the leader of God's people. We know Jesus was that as well. Moses led the people out of bondage and towards the promised land. Well, that one's very obvious, of course. Jesus does the same thing spiritually. In fact, the whole story of Israel, and especially this part of Israel, is simply a foreshadowing, a type of what was to come with Christ and leading us out of spiritual bondage, leading us towards the heavenly land that the Hebrew writer was just talking about a few verses prior. And then another way that Moses was a type of Christ was that he was a lawgiver. He gave a law from God to the people that we call the law of Moses. And of course, Jesus brought a new covenant and new law for us today. But he was also like Christ in that he suffered reproach and rejection, and he even did so from God's people. He suffered reproach and rejection from the Israelites at the very beginning when he tried to become their leader and tried to deliver them. Stephen brings that out in Acts chapter 7, that he thought that they should have understood that that was the case, but they rejected him just like they had always rejected God's leaders and continued to do so throughout Israel's history. But he suffered rejection from them then, and then along the way, as he was leading them, so many times they rebelled against Moses and against God. So that was in one way how he was suffering the reproach of Christ. But another similar and related way that he was suffering the reproach of Christ is that this was a reproach that was for the cause of Christ. It was for the sake of Christ. And the reason the Hebrew author wrote this letter to the Hebrew Christians is because they were suffering reproach for the cause of Christ. And they were contemplating giving up on Christianity and going back to Judaism because of the reproach that they were suffering. And they needed to see that these heroes of old, their Hebrew ancestors, they needed to see them in the light of Christ. They needed to see them as doing the same thing as that they were doing themselves, that they were experiencing thousands of years later. Moses, who they would have revered, he suffered just like they were suffering. And by identifying with the people of God, he suffered in the same way they're suffering, that is, for the cause of Christ. They needed encouragement. They needed to look at examples like Moses and how Moses showed them and how these examples, like Moses, show them that the people of God have always suffered reproach. And it happens in every era, in every part of the peoples of God's history. There's always the suffering at the hands of those who reject God and reject God's plan for them. So Moses is a tremendous example of faith in the sense that he did exactly what Jesus did and what we are called to do as well. And he suffered the same things that we are going to suffer. Now, you and I today, we live in actually what's an anomaly in world history as far as Christianity is concerned and the suffering that Christians endure or have endured throughout time. You and I in the United States of America, we've probably got it better than at any other time in history, save for maybe a little bit of time in the Roman Empire, but of course apostasy was already happening at that point. But for the most part, throughout the world, in every era, God's people have always been persecuted and have always suffered reproach. So this is nothing new, he's saying. Look at Moses. Look at what he endured. You can do it too. Look at what he was looking forward to. You look forward to the same thing.
What a powerful reminder of what our podcast is about, On Things Above. Moses was looking somewhere other than the world. He was looking and had his mind set on things above. Jared, in Acts chapter 7, Stephen, in his sermon, gives a review of the history of Israel and gives us some clues that are not revealed either in the Exodus account or Hebrews 11. For instance, he says that it entered Moses' mind or his heart to visit his brethren at the age of 40. It also tells us that when he was a little baby and was hidden by his parents, that they saw that he was lovely in the sight of God, which ought to give us all hope that even Moses at one time was a basket case. But Jarrett, tell us about Stephen's sermon and how we have a greater appreciation of Moses through him.
Yeah, so Marshall, you alluded to this earlier, but in Acts 7, that's where Stephen, he makes his defense before being stoned, and he becomes this first martyr for the cause of Christ. But he says in verse 22 of Acts chapter 7 that Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians. He was a man of power in words and in deeds. But when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw that one of them, being treated unjustly, he defended him. He took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren would understand that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. And so I think Stephen picks up on something very interesting here that maybe we wouldn't get just from the account that we read in Exodus. He seems to indicate that when Moses struck down that Egyptian, Moses was anticipating deliverance of his people, that they would somehow follow his lead and that they would free themselves. And that would make sense because Moses, like you mentioned earlier, he's already that high-ranking official in Egypt. He had many connections. He's in this perfect position to be the deliverer for God's people. But God, he had a different plan. Instead, God led him out to the wilderness to become just a humble shepherd before God decides that Moses is ready to go back to Egypt and to be that deliverer for his people. And there are two quick lessons that I see in that for us. One, God often has a different plan than we do, or at least he accomplishes that plan in a way that we wouldn't expect. It kind of reminds me of when Paul is in prison and he writes to the Philippians about how his imprisonment has actually turned out for the greater progress of the gospel. So even though that wasn't his plan, even though that wasn't what he expected, you know, to be imprisoned, it turned out for the better because now the whole Praetorian Guard is exposed to the gospel. And so God, he often accomplishes his plans in ways that we don't expect. And maybe we see a lot of that going on right now, a lot of unexpected things. But if we're looking closely, maybe we're seeing the plans of God and the purposes of God still being fulfilled in ways that we wouldn't anticipate. But the other thing is that God uses the humble to accomplish his purposes. Shepherding is not a glamorous job in any way. It's low end, hard labor, a very humbling kind of job that must have been extremely different from the extravagant life that he lived in Egypt. But it prepared him just as much to become the leader for God's people. And by the time he leads God's people out of Egypt, he's described in Numbers 12 and verse 3 as more meek or humble than anyone on the earth. And so from that moment that Moses strikes the Egyptian to the time that he finally returns after those 40 years of shepherding to deliver the Israelites, I think we see that God's plans are often different than ours, and that he uses the humble to accomplish his purposes.
We sometimes think of those three segments of Moses' life being unrelated. But really, 40 years learning to be a leader and then 40 years learning to be a shepherd helped him in those last 40 years to lead the sheep of Israel. And Marshall, there is a second half of Hebrews 11 that are also related to the verses before. Moses did not fear the wrath of the king when he left Egypt, just like his parents were not afraid of the king's edict. He did so seeing him who is unseen, just as he was looking to the reward. So take us back to Hebrews 11 and verse 27 to tell us more about Moses.
Yeah, that theme of looking to what was coming continues in these verses, as you stated there. And it's because of that vision of where he was looking that he was able to do what he did. Now it says in verse 27 that he was not afraid of the anger of the king. You know, he left Egypt and he was not afraid of the anger of the king. Let me just quickly mention that there are many who find a little bit of a trouble with that verse, because in the Exodus account, when he kills the Egyptian, he flees Egypt, and it specifically states that he did so because he was afraid. And so this seems like a contradiction on the surface. But I think the very easy answer to that is that this is not referencing his first leaving of Egypt at the age of 40. This is now starting that second part, or actually it's the third part of his life when he was 80 years old, as the leader of God's people and him leading them out of Egypt. That's the reference here. The leaving Egypt that he is referring to is the second time he left Egypt, but this time as the leader and taking them out of Egypt and taking them to the promised land. And so in that time, he was not afraid of the anger of the king. Why? The second half of verse 27 tells us. Because he endured as seeing him who was invisible. He knew God. He knew God better now than he ever did in those first 40 years of his life. He knew the power of God now better than he ever did in those first 40 years of his life. Over the past 80 years, over the past 40 years, rather. During that time in Midian, as, like Jarrett said, he was being humbled and being taught as a shepherd. And then, of course, the signs that God had shown him. He sees God in the burning bush. He has the miracles that he is able to do when God tells him to throw down a staff and to put his hand in his bosom and shows what he can do. And he brings Aaron, his brother, to him. While he is still unsure of himself, and while there is some wavering of faith there, ultimately, though, he does have that faith in God that he does set out, and he knows what God can do. And then, of course, as you go through that account of him asking Pharaoh to let the people go and the plagues and so forth, all of those plagues were not just solely meant as signs for the Egyptians and for Pharaoh and a judgment upon the gods of Egypt. While all that is true, what it was also for, it was for Moses, and it was for the Israelites to see. You see what God is doing? You can't see God. He is invisible, but you look at what God is doing. They could see visible effects. They could see visible manifestations of God in these plagues and in these great signs that he was doing. And so there was no reason to be afraid, because he knew who, as we say in our vernacular, he knew who had his back. He knew that God was there, and he was the one that literally went before them, but also at one point as they are leaving Egypt is behind them in between Israel and the Egyptians. And so in that sense, he had their back. So he was not afraid of the anger of the king. He saw what God could do. He saw what God would do. There is no reason to doubt him. And then continuing on at verse 28, by faith he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. You talk about typology once again, and we could spend all day talking about this verse alone and all the references to Christ that is wrapped up in the Passover. Won't go into all of that, but just briefly mention that the New Testament refers to Jesus as our Passover, as our Passover lamb. It's his blood that is sprinkled upon us that that cleanses us, and that we can be, we don't have to worry about the destroyer. We will not be touched by death. We will die physically, but we will not be ultimately touched by death. We will not suffer the eternal death. And so that Passover, which celebrated their deliverance from Egypt, he kept that by faith, and he did that the night that they were going to be leaving. So they hadn't actually left yet. It was in the process, but he knew what was coming, and he had faith that God would see them through that. And he had faith that God would do what he said, and that is he would not kill the firstborn of any house that had the blood on the door of the house. And he believed him, and he did it, which, of course, is a point that the Hebrew writer makes with every single one of these characters, is that the faith was an actionable faith. They did something. Here Moses acts on faith, and he leads the Israelites to do the same thing, and to act on faith and do what it is that God told them to do. Because they were seeing their freedom. They were on the doorstep of their freedom, of their deliverance. And this moves on into crossing the Red Sea in verse 29. And who is it that God is protecting? Who is it that God is working with? It is with Moses and the people of Israel. And he destroys the enemies of God's people. This is another theme that you see throughout Scripture, is that God protects his people, and he always destroys the enemies of God's people. Now, that may or may not always happen in the physical realm and in the temporal life that we live. It may seem like the enemies of God get away with what they're doing, and they don't ever pay for what it is that they're doing. They don't get their comeuppance, so to speak. But those times that they do, which are numerous, those are simply a foreshadowing of what is to come with the final judgment upon God's enemies and vindication of God's people. And that's what the story of the deliverance from Egypt is about. It's judgment upon the enemies of God, and it's vindication of God's people. It's deliverance from bondage and from those things that are holding God's people down, and it is a lifting them up and giving them their freedom and vindicating them because they have shown faith. Well, Moses is the leader of all of that. He's the one that is getting these people, these millions of people, to do this. They're afraid. That is mentioned several times. Moses continues to be rejected by the people through this in various ways. And yet, he's the constant. Moses is the constant. He's the one that continues to demonstrate that faith because he knows the reward that's coming. He knows the deliverance that is coming. And of course, the point where the Hebrew writer is going with all of this is, and what the dots that he expects them to connect, is that what they were going through was really no different than what Moses and the Israelites went through. And they needed to see that Jesus was providing them that escape from Egypt, that Jesus was providing them that deliverance from bondage. And it wasn't just the deliverance and getting out of that bad situation, but it was taking them to somewhere much greater. It wasn't just freedom, it was freedom and a place of rest. And so verse 30 starts to bring that in. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. That's the beginning of the conquest of the land of Canaan. That's the beginning of them moving into that promised land and the land where they could experience rest. And it is the beginning of victory for them. God's people will always be victorious. They will always be able to defeat the enemies of God if they have faith. And of course, we know the story about the times that they did not have faith while they were traveling towards the promised land. And especially when they were first told to go up and take the land, you know, God sent the 12 spies in, and the plan was for them to attack at that point and to go into the land, but 10 of the spies came back and says, we can't do it. They were faithless. And that persuaded the whole congregation of Israel to take that same stance that we cannot do it. They did not have faith at that point. But when they do have faith, and when the leaders express faith and the people follow in that faith, then look at what they're able to accomplish. Not they themselves, but what God can accomplish through them. And the Hebrew writer has to be making that point to these people. Yes, you're suffering right now, but look at what Moses did. Look at what the Israelites did. And they were victorious. You're going to be victorious too. You're suffering now, but there is that deliverance coming. And if Moses could do it, if the children of Israel could do it, then you can do it too. You will have that same victory as well. That looking to the heavenly reward is hard to do in the moment. It's hard to do when you're feeling the pains of that reproach and persecution. It's hard to do when you see your family killed because of the cause of Christ. It's hard to do when you see your friends, your brethren, suffer because they're Christians. It's a whole lot easier to just say, you know what, this is not worth it, and maybe it'd be better if I just not do anything with this right now, put it on the back burner. Maybe I'll come back to it some other time. Maybe I'll just hide it. Maybe I'll just hide that light, put it under a bushel. That's the easy way out. It takes faith to see that there is something beyond. It takes faith to see beyond the suffering, just like Moses saw beyond the suffering. And he chose to endure that. I'm kind of going back to the first half now for just a moment, but this is a point that is made in both parts of this. But he chose to do that and reject the passing pleasures of sin. And that is a hard decision for you and I to make. The pleasures of sin, there is no doubt that sin is pleasurable. And it's hard to get past that and to say, why should I have to give this up? This is so good right now. I'm enjoying this right now. This is the way I like to live. This is what I want to do. It's hard to put that aside and say, that's not worth it. Suffering is worth it. The only way that we can do that is to have the faith of Moses and to look beyond the reproach and actually change the way we view that reproach. Instead of viewing it as a negative, view it as a positive, knowing what's attached to it. And that is the reward, the deliverance, the promised land that he is leading us to.
It's not just the fact that Moses is mentioned so often in the scriptures, but the superlatives that are used and attached to him. Jarrett's already mentioned that he was very humble or meek, more than any man on the face of the earth. When he died, it said, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. We read that in Exodus 33 and verse 11, the Lord spoke to Moses just as a man speaks to his friend. So, Jarrett, it is natural for those in the first century who for 1,500 years had kept the law of Moses, had revered the law of Moses, are now being told that there is one greater than Moses, and that is Jesus Christ. Tell us about that conflict.
In Deuteronomy 18 and verse 15, it says that God would raise up a prophet like unto Moses. And there are several parallels between Moses and Jesus that sort of stand out to us. One is they are both nearly killed as infants because of the king's decree. They both grew up for some time in Egypt and became like their brethren. They both have miraculous moments with God on a mountain in the burning bush and in the transfiguration. They're both described as meek and lowly, and they're both mediators and intercessors between God and man. But the Hebrew writer, like you mentioned, Bubba, he's not interested in just how they are the same, but how Jesus is far superior. So it says in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 3 that Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. So Moses, like we've talked about this whole time, is only a shadow of Christ. Because while Moses spoke the word of the Lord to Israel, Jesus is the word that became flesh and dwelt among us. Moses was willing to give up his life for the sins of Israel, but Jesus ultimately did sacrifice his life for the sins of all people. And Moses may have delivered Israel out of slavery to Egypt and into the land of Canaan, but Jesus delivered all people out of slavery to sin and death and into the ultimate land of promise in heaven above. Moses is the house, but the architect and builder of all things is Jesus, the greater Moses.
Our hearts go out to Moses because of his sin, where God said, "You did not treat me as holy." The psalmist says that Moses spoke rashly with his lips when he said, "Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" And for that reason, God said, "You shall not enter this land." Later, he begged God to let him go in. And the Lord said, "Speak to me no more of this matter." It would not be until the transfiguration of Jesus on the mountain, where Peter, James, and John saw Jesus talking with Moses and Elijah, that the feet of Moses stood firmly in Canaan's land. But I imagine by that time, Moses had seen greater things, for even then, he was looking to the reward. Let us, like him, keep our thoughts and our hearts and our minds on things above and not on things on the earth. Thank you for joining us, Marshall. Well done, brother. Great to see you again.
It's been great to be a part of it. Thank you for having me.
We look forward to another podcast of On Things Above. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you then.